listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hey, this is Shane Vanderhart. Happy Friday. To close out the week, I wanted to play you an interview that Brian Myers did with Dr. E. Calvin Beisner. He's the national spokesperson for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. But before we get to that interview, first a word from our sponsors.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Without further ado, here is Brian Myers, who's a senior contributor with Caffeinated Thoughts. His interview with Dr. E. Calvin Beisner of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation.
Dr. E. Calvin Beisner is founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, a network of over 60 Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast, Cal.
Thanks very much, Brian. Great to be back with you.
We've interviewed you multiple times over the years. Today I wanted to do something we haven't done in the past, and that's get Cal Beisner's story. I'd like to know more about your background, what you're passionate about, and how and why you ended up founding the Cornwall Alliance. And when we get through all of that, then maybe I'd like to talk to you about our favorite subject, the climate change debate and so on.
And we had, what, 4 hours for this?
You're going to have to compress this story, pal.
All right, I will do my best. Believe it or not, that actually involves starting out when I was a very little child.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You lived in India, right?
I did indeed. As a little toddler, when my father worked with the State Department, we were stationed in Calcutta, India, which is now called Kolkata. At any rate, it was an extremely impoverished place and extremely dirty and filled with disease. Shortly after we arrived there, my mother contracted a virus that paralyzed her.
Wow.
Because of that, I couldn't be taken care of at home, and so every day an Indian ayah or nurse would arrive at our apartment and take me by the hand and walk me several blocks to the home of an Indian family where I would spend the day. Consequently, by the way, since I spent about 6 months doing that, Hindi was the first language that I spoke.
Is
that
right?
I only remember one word. That is Nimbupani, which means lemonade. Go figure. But on the way down, we went through the courtyard of our apartment building, and there was a huge green tree in the middle of the courtyard, and from it hung a beautiful vine with very big red blossoms. Of course, huge and big are the estimates of a toddler at the time, so not sure just how big these were, but they were big to me. And they were very, very beautiful. And I have, despite my my very young age at the time, I still have picture memories of that and its beauty in my mind. Much later, when I became a Christian and began to learn about God's creation and its wonders, that patched into that early memory. I realized that God had given me this picture memory from early on to capture my heart for the beauty of God's creation and the importance of sustaining that beauty and even enhancing it. But then, after going through the courtyard, we walked out onto the streets. And we would walk a number of blocks, and along those blocks, every morning, we were out very early in the morning, and the trucks had not yet come around to pick up the bodies of those who had died overnight of starvation and disease. And so literally, every morning for 6 months, I was stepping over dead bodies.
Wow.
And I have those pictures indelibly imprinted in my mind as well. And they tell me of the horrors of poverty. And again, later when I became a Christian, I came to thank God for having given me those pictures, those experiences, because they motivated me to see the tremendous importance of overcoming poverty. It just brings so much suffering into this world.
Well, and what an incredible juxtaposition between those two pictures you just described.
Yeah, the beauty of God's creation and the just terrible, terrible things of extreme poverty. And so as a Christian, as I grew in my Christian faith, I was initially really focused on evangelizing people and doing Christian apologetics, reasons why we believe. And I still have done those things all the years since then. But little by little, as I studied the Bible and found that it taught a great deal about economics, about overcoming poverty, about Christians taking care of the poor, helping them, and that it taught a great deal about being good stewards of God's creation, about the beauty of it and the need for us to cultivate that. When in the 1980s I eventually was asked to write first a book on Christian economics and then a book on how biblical faith and worldview and theology and ethics inform our understanding of population and resources and the environment, I realized that those two things really tied together. Overcoming poverty and being good stewards of the environment go hand in hand, because as I came to understand, a clean, helpful, beautiful environment is a costly good. And like any other costly good, wealthier people can afford more than poorer people can. That's why, far from being a threat to the environment, economic development, economic growth, is the best friend the environment can have. I mean, after
absolutely.
All, you don't go to the wealthiest parts of town to see filth and
squalor.
Disease. You go to the poorest parts, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't go, frankly, to the freest parts of the world to see filth. You go to those parts of the world that have been dominated by centralized communist or socialist governments that rob people of the incentive to take good care of property. Private property and wealth are a good friend to the environment.
Okay.
We're going to come back
to that just here shortly, Cal. I want to back you up just a little bit here. You mentioned your father was in the State Department, and then eventually he was a newspaper guy too, correct? So tell me a little bit about your father.
Indeed. Yeah, he was a lifelong journalist. Even when he was fighting on Okinawa in World War II, he was also in charge of his company's little newspaper, and so he did that even during the war. He edited and published newspapers. He was a reporter. He managed state press associations. He taught journalism in college and graduate school. So he did all of that. And one of the things that he taught me is the absolute importance of journalists getting the story straight, telling a straight story instead of editorializing, pushing their own opinions in the name of reporting. A good reporter, you can't tell where he stands on an issue. There's room for editorializing, but that's supposed to be in the editorial columns, in the what used to be called the op-ed page, the page opposite the editorials, where columnists would voice their opinions. So that was an important thing for me, and it has helped me to recognize the tremendous extent to which most journalistic handling of environmental issues of all sorts, but especially climate change, are just simply propaganda. They're not true journalism at all.
Okay, moving on real quickly to your education. I got to go fast through all this stuff, Cal. I apologize, but
okay.
You earned a bachelor's degree in interdisciplinary studies in religion and philosophy at the University of Southern California. Then you got your master's degree from International College. But then you pursued your PhD in Scottish history / history of political thought at St. Andrews in Scotland. And now, if I understand it correctly, your PhD dissertation, in your dissertation, you draw a link between Samuel Rutherford and John Locke. And the link is through a guy named Sir James Stuart of Goodtrees. Do I have all this correct?
You have it exactly right. Yeah, James Stuart of Goodtrees was a Scottish Covenanter, a lawyer, a politician, and sort of an amateur theologian. He actually wrote a commentary on the Book of Revelation, but that is either destroyed or hidden away somewhere. Nobody knows just where it is. But he was in opposition to the what's called the Stuart Restoration Monarchy. That is, when Charles II regained the throne of England and Scotland in 1660, he followed his grandfather and father's position of believing that the king was absolute, that his word was law, and that there was never any excuse for disobeying the king. If what you did in disobeying the king was wrong, the king would answer for it to God, not you. That also meant that there was absolutely no justification ever for citizens to resist higher authority, particularly at the height of the king. But Samuel Rutherford, in his book Lex Rex, or The Law and the Prince, and James Stuart of Goodtrees, in his books Naphtali, or The Wrestling of the Church of Scotland, and Jus Populi Vindicatum, or The Right of the People to defend their lives, liberty, and covenanted religion, vindicated, they argued that the Bible actually does limit the authority of the government, particularly at any given level, right up to the very top officers in the government, and that citizens have a right and sometimes even a duty to resist tyranny. And those ideas were forwarded as well by John Locke, and I know from historical records that Locke and James Stuart of Goodtrees were close buddies together around the throne of the court of Prince William of Orange in The Hague in Holland, prior to William's coming to England in 1688 in what later was called the Glorious Revolution, in which he drove out King James II, and ultimately was offered the throne by both England and Scotland and took it, becoming William III. This thinking is a part of a whole stream of thought running from the 1530s right through to the early 1700s that historians of political thought call Calvinist resistance theory, and it heavily influenced the founders of the United States of America, such that you can actually footnote every clause of the principles paragraph in our Declaration of Independence, you know, the one that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident."
Mm-hmm.
You can footnote every clause of that to James Stuart of Goodtrees' book, Jus Populi Vindicatum.
Really?
1669.
Wow. But yeah, I find this fascinating because when I was in high school a millennia or two ago, We discussed the influence of Locke and Rousseau. I remember that. But at the time, I had no idea who Samuel Rutherford was. It was many years later when I discovered Rutherford. And as you mentioned, Rutherford's perhaps best known as the author of Lex Rex. And that book was truly a radical work in its day, wasn't it?
It was. And by the way, when you studied Locke in college, I would guess, or in high school, you probably were introduced to him as a sort of an armchair, pre-Enlightenment secularist philosopher. The truth is that John Locke was a very dedicated Christian, a Puritan. He wrote a book in defense of the reasonableness of Christianity, a book in defense of the doctrine of the Trinity, a book in defense of the inspiration and authority of the Bible. He wrote his own what's called commonplaces. This is where pastors usually would write down for themselves in a journal passages from the Bible on particular topics, sort of a topical Bible for themselves. His own was much larger than most pastors' copies were. He was a profoundly Christian man, and most people, when they get to his political writing, only read his second treatise on government. And that sounds fairly secular, but that's because he was arguing to a secular crowd in that. The first treatise on government was loaded with biblical defenses of his position.
And I take it that you're suggesting that he was under a fair amount of influence from his friend, James Stuart of Goodtrees, who had also been influenced by Rutherford.
That's correct, who, by the way, had been influenced by John Calvin. And Locke's entire notion of human rights, which underlies the International Declaration on Human Rights, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights adopted by the United Nations, Locke's entire notion of human rights rests on his belief that the Bible is the Word of God and that the Ten Commandments are the law of God. And if you take that foundation under it, out from under it, the whole thing crumbles.
Collapses.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Before I move on, anything else you'd like to add, to this discussion of your dissertation?
Well, you said that we didn't have 4 hours.
You're right, we don't. Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about your career. You were associate professor at Knox Theological Seminary in social ethics and historical theology for about 8 years, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and you focused on the application of what you refer to as a biblical worldview. So then in 1992, so this predates all that, you were teaching at Covenant College. What did you teach there?
Well, at Covenant College, I was associate professor of interdisciplinary studies, focusing on the application of biblical worldview, theology, and ethics to economics, government, and public policy. I also taught some courses in the history of political thought and similar issues. But my main concern for the last 30 years of my career has been, as I put it, the application of biblical worldview, theology, and ethics to economics, government, public policy, particularly to environment and to poverty, overcoming poverty, economic development.
Well, do I take it that at some point you felt that you just simply didn't want to teach anymore and you wanted to become more active in making some changes relative to these concerns you had? Or, I mean, what was the precipitating event or what have you relative to you leaving your position as a professor?
Well, the whole time that I taught at Covenant College, I was only part-time because I really did want to pursue continued research and writing, publishing in the economics and environment fields. And so I did that, and I was involved in a number of different meetings of Christian scholars on environmental stewardship throughout the 1990s. And in 1999, a group of us got together in West Cornwall, Connecticut, and spent a few days just hammering out basic principles. And that ultimately led to the drafting of what became known as the Cornwall Declaration on Environmental Stewardship, which was signed initially by a few hundred and then pretty quickly by over 1,500 religious leaders of various stripes around the United States and the world, and ultimately by many, many thousands of citizens and so on. And out of that, we intended to start a little organization called the Interfaith Council for Environmental Stewardship, and the idea had been that I would head that up. But at that time, in early 2000, I accepted a position teaching at Knox Theological Seminary, which meant that I would be moving from teaching interdisciplinary studies to teaching historical theology, social ethics, a bunch of courses that I'd never even taken before, let alone taught before. And so I knew I wouldn't have the time to head up ICES. But after a few years there, I finished my PhD dissertation. I had taught all my Knox courses several times over, and I said, okay, I can take the time now to start up the Interfaith Council on Environmental Stewardship. We actually gave it a different name to start with, the Interfaith Stewardship Alliance. And then a couple of years later, we changed that to the Cornwall Declaration on to the Cornwall Alliance for Environmental Stewardship, because that would tie into our founding document, the Cornwall Declaration, better. And just over the years, that grew. It required more and more of my time, and I found that it was just more, shall we say, it was more intellectually challenging. And then at the same time, there were, in 2007 and 2008, some major changes in the leadership and vision of Knox Theological Seminary. And so I just decided that I would pour my whole life into Cornwall Alliance and a church that I had helped to plant and on which I was serving on the pastoral staff. So I left Knox and became half-time pastor and half-time running Cornwall Alliance, and eventually the church grew to the point where it could call the marvelous theologian Dr. Robert L. Raymond as its full-time stated supply pastor, and Cornwall Alliance grew to the point where it needed me full-time.
Okay, so, but to back your story up just a little bit, you were already apparently then heavily involved in interest, you might say, about environmental issues when you're still neck deep in your PhD studies of 17th century Scottish history and politics.
Yes, and in fact, the studies on environmental issues began nearly a decade before I began my PhD studies. Started the PhD studies in 95. Managed to cram a 3-year degree into 7 years. after all, raising 7 kids and teaching and moving and all that stuff takes a little time. But I really began studying the population resources environment connection of things in the late 1980s, having been asked to write a book for the Turning Point Christian Worldview series by Crossway Books on biblical approach to economics, and a chapter that was supposed to deal with population resources in the environment. And as I worked on it, I just told Dr. Marvin Alasky, the series editor, I can't put that into a chapter. And he said, well, fine, do another whole book just on that, which eventually came to my book, Prospects for Growth, A Biblical View of Population Resources in the Future, published in 1990.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your interest in environmentalism. I remember the last time you and I were together, I think was for the Caffeinated Thoughts briefing 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I remember at the time you and I were sharing a laugh at President Obama's assertion that climate change represented a far greater threat than ISIS did. And then I saw you, your face went from a smile to a sort of a serious look, and I knew exactly what you were going to say before you said it. And you said, there's a sense in which he's right. And of course, I knew at the time you were suggesting that he was right, but he was also 180 degrees out of phase.
Yeah.
That climate change does represent a threat, but an entirely different threat than what Mr. Obama assumes.
Yes. That is correct. Now, what we have to do is do a little defining of terms.
Yes.
Starting with the term climate change, because that has become sort of shorthand for what is more properly called dangerous man-made global warming, or, to be even more specific, man-made global warming so dangerous that it justifies our spending trillions of dollars that could otherwise be spent to overcome poverty, to provide purified drinking water, sewage sanitation, nutrition supplements, health care, electricity for homes, education, and so on. That's what's really behind that simple two-word phrase, climate change. Now, next point that we need to clarify is, what do we mean by a threat? And in my looking at this, I think the efforts to mitigate climate change, to reduce human impact on global average temperature, actually constitute a far greater threat to human well-being than any changes in global temperature
absolutely
might cause.
Absolutely. That is absolutely true. Well, where exactly are we at right now with regard to the debate? What is the current state of the climate change debate? Bring us up to speed, Cal.
Well, you have Al Gore telling us that this this great polar vortex and the nor'easter, what they called this bomb, this cold bomb that came over the past week to North America here, is exactly what you would predict because of global warming. And, of course, what that really tells us is that in his understanding of global warming, it can explain absolutely everything.
That's
which
right.
Makes it what logicians call a tautology. It explains everything and therefore explains nothing.
That's exactly right.
But the reality is this. The computer models on which all the fears of dangerous man-made global warming are based predict 2 to 3 times as much warming as has actually been observed over the relevant period. Now, the late Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman told us in a wonderful little video that you can see on YouTube called The Key to Science. He said, here's the key to science. When you want to understand how something in nature works, first you guess. Then you make predictions based on your guess, or a guess of what you should see in the real world if your guess is right. Then you compare your predictions with observations in the laboratory or out in nature. And he said, if the observations contradict your predictions, your guess is wrong, period. That's the key to science. So here's the guess. The guess is that human emissions of carbon dioxide are going to have a strong warming effect on the Earth's atmosphere.
Right.
The observation is that it has a very tiny warming effect on the atmosphere. The result is that you have to abandon your hypothesis. You have to correct it and change it. And unfortunately, a lot of the people on the alarmist side are simply not willing to do that. There have been exceptions. People like Dr. Judith Curry, former chairman of the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the university at Georgia Tech University, who heads up Climate Etc., her website. She's a world-recognized climate scientist and one of the lead authors in the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for a long time. And about a decade ago now, she began committing heresy. Treason, to the cause. She actually began thinking carefully through what the critics of climate alarmism were saying, and she got persuaded, and she's now become one of the biggest critics. She's one of many who have done that. But unfortunately, those who are politically connected have managed to continue to control the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that has been resorted to by governments around the world, and actually that was the intent when it was founded back in 1989. It was intended to be a governmental activity, a bureaucratic one, not so much a scientific one. And the result is that you continue having these scary stories, but the empirical evidence is very, very strong. Human activity surely does contribute something to making the atmosphere warmer than it otherwise would be.
Right.
But the interesting questions are how much warmer, when, where, and what would be the balance of benefits and costs to our trying to reduce that. The answers are so little warmer that you can't detect it, and in the winter, at night, and toward the poles, which is exactly where the warming is the most beneficial. And any attempt to reduce our contribution to warming would be simply a complete waste. The Paris Climate Agreement, for example, would cost us approximately $1 to $2 trillion per year from 2030 to 2100 to implement. And even assuming that they're right about how much that would reduce global temperature, the benefit would be 0.3 of a degree Fahrenheit less warming at the end of the century. That's too little to affect any ecosystem, and certainly too little to have any impact on human well-being. So what we're being asked to do is to spend $23.3 to $46.6 trillion for every 0.1 of a degree Fahrenheit of reduction in global temperature. And it's not surprising to me that the author of The Art of the Deal recognized that that was a bad deal.
Well, as you mentioned, Cal, there's a lot of stuff crammed into the little phrase climate change.
Yes, indeed.
And you unpacked that phrase for us. I would suggest that one of the most important subjects within that little phrase is indeed the computer models. And the reason it's so important is because virtually all the public policy throughout the world relative to climate change is supposed to be based on these models, correct?
That is correct. And the simple fact is that the models have been falsified. Therefore, they provide absolutely zero rational basis for any predictions of future temperature, and therefore also zero rational basis for any policy related to future temperature.
If memory serves me correctly, I believe Dr. John Christie told me last year that the computer models were, on average, showing 2.5 times the amount of warming versus his observations. And the last graph I saw that he put together shows roughly a 0.6 degree Celsius differential between the satellite data and the average of 102 IPCC model runs. Does that sound correct as well?
That's right about on target. But there's something else that we need to add to that.
Okay.
And, Dr. Christie and Dr. Joe DeLeo and Dr. James Wallace, in a paper published last fall and revised last spring on the alleged tropical hotspot, which is a technical term that people don't need really to hang on to, but it is the basis of the U.S. government's policy on global warming. This paper actually demonstrates that if you control properly for, in terms of statistical analysis, if you control properly for solar variability, volcanic variability, and especially ocean current variability, particularly the El Nino, La Nina southern oscillation that goes on in the South Pacific. If you control for those, you have explained all of the global temperature variability over the relevant period. That means that there is no warming left to blame on carbon dioxide.
Wow.
Now, the models predict 2 to 3 times as much warming as actually observed, but that sounds like they just exaggerate the warming effect of CO2 by 2 to 3 times. No. The reality is that once you control for those other factors, there's no warming left to blame on CO2 that is enough for us to detect. That means that instead of exaggerating by 2 or 3 times, the models exaggerate by hundreds of times. They are far more wrong than anybody realized, even as little as a year and a half or 2 years ago.
All right, I want to zero in on something you said here a moment or two ago, Cal. Is it fair to say that some models are relatively close to reality? In other words, could one say that there do exist some reliable climate models, or are they all bad? I mean, are they all so bad as to render them essentially useless? I think that's what you said a couple of moments ago.
I have been talking all along about the average of what's called the CMIP-5, the computer climate model intercomparison project. CMIP-5, anyway, is what they work with. I've been talking about those models, and they're the ones on which the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and various national agencies all around the world depend. Those are abysmally wrong, and none of them is decent at all. None of them predicted the essential complete absence of statistically significant warming over the last 20 years. None of them predicted 95% of them failed to predict the cooling that occurred in the middle of that period. So those models are just wrong, wrong, wrong. There are, however, a few different models, basically some very, very simple ones that actually do a pretty good job. And one of them was put together by my friend David LeGates, a PhD in climatology, professor of climatology and geography at the University of Delaware. And Christopher Monckton, Lord Christopher Monckton in Britain, who is a self-educated scientist and mathematician, and another mathematician. And they published an article about, 3 years ago, a simple model on detecting or predicting the impact of added CO2 on the atmosphere. And that very, very simple model turns out to have been quite accurate in showing that, yeah, CO2 makes it a little bit warmer, but the amount is so small that we cannot detect it.
But I take it from what you said, though, that the models that are typically used, and certainly used by the IPCC, those are models that that you would not go so far as to say there's any reliability into. Is that correct?
None.
Okay.
What's interesting, though, and Brian, this is something that people need to understand. The folks who defend those models will say, well, we can show very clearly that they can retrodict. They can be applied to the past, and they can match the temperature variability over the past century very well. Okay, that sounds like it's a good defense of the models, but in fact, any modeler will tell you that that's an exercise in what's called curve fitting. And I think you can sum that up best by reference to one physicist. I think it was Enrico Fermi who said, "Give me three variables, and I'll model you an elephant. Give me four, and I'll make its trunk swing." The fact is, if you know in advance what you're trying to picture, you can control the parameters. You can plug in values so as to get that picture. You don't understand the system you're trying to model until you can predict the future behavior of that system
right.
with accuracy. And we've never been able to do that with any of the CMIP-5 or earlier models on which the UN IPCC depends.
Well, I understand from Dr. Curry that a couple of years ago, even the IPCC downgraded their expected warming due to the evident inaccuracy of the models.
Yes, for about 30 years. Well, actually, all the way back to 1978 and U.S. government study that was done then, from then until 2013, the consensus was that doubling CO2 content in the atmosphere would raise global average temperature by anywhere from 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, with a best estimate of 3 degrees, right dead center in that. In 2013, the UN IPCC changed that range from 1.5 to 1 degree to 4.5 degrees Celsius, still with a best estimate of around 3 degrees. So, in other words, after 40 years of research costing billions and billions of dollars on all this modeling, what we have done is decided we know less now than we did 40 years ago. That's not exactly the way science is supposed to develop increasing understanding of things. And then besides that, the empirical research shows that CO2's warming effect is surely much, much smaller than that. Many different scholars are now saying in the range of 0.3 to 1.7 degrees Celsius, with a best estimate running somewhere around 0.8 to 1.0 degrees Celsius. And yet, even some more recent studies, like the one that I mentioned a little bit ago by Dr. Christie, Dr. DeLeo, and Dr. Wallace, those indicate that the warming is so small that we can't even detect it.
Incredible. And yet we're busy trying to throw away the economic prosperity of the entire Western world chasing this. It's amazing.
Yes. Well, this is why I'm concerned about it, because as a Christian, as someone who's committed to seeing people rise out of poverty, I'm horrified by the policies being pushed in the name of fighting global warming. All of these policies would require depriving the developing world of the abundant, affordable, reliable energy, especially in the form of electricity, mm-hmm. that for that part of the world can only be had through the use of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. Those are going to lift those people out of poverty. Right now, the average sub-Saharan African woman spends 6 to 8 hours a day doing nothing but gathering wood and dried dung to use as her primary cooking and heating fuels. The smoke from that stuff kills 2 to 4 million people a year, mostly women and young children. And if they could have electrification for their homes, they would be delivered from that smoke, and they would have light to study by at night so that they could learn the things they need to really rise out of poverty and become more productive. I think the whole global warming alarmist bandwagon is, whether intended or not, the actual effect is going to be condemn billions of people to remaining in poverty for generations to come. And that, I think, is morally unconscionable.
I would agree. I would definitely agree. Well, Cal, I've already kept you 9 minutes beyond what I said I would. I want to thank you so much for coming on with me again today. Real quickly, give us some contact data for Cornwall Alliance. If people want to get in touch with you or find out more about the Alliance, where do they need to go?
Place to go is cornwallalliance.org. That's cornwallalliance.org. And Brian, during the month of January here, we are offering a free DVD of my lecture, Climate Change and the Christian. It's probably the most detailed, most thorough lecture on this that I've ever done. And it incorporates the PowerPoint slides that show all the various data graphs and things like that that make everything so easily understood. So if people will go to cornwallalliance.org and then sign up for our free weekly email newsletter, they will get the information on how to get that DVD lecture absolutely free.
Sounds fantastic. Cal, thanks again so much. It was really a lot of fun talking about your background, finding out a little bit about what makes you tick, and maybe what ticks you off. And also
a bit of that too.
As always, got a great education along the way. Thanks again, Dr. Cal Beisner, for being with us on the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's caffeinatedthoughts.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our email updates, that way you don't miss a single article. Again, until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.